Hello, welcome everybody to tonight's webinar, which is the third in our webinar series between MHPN and Emerging Minds. And tonight we're going to be talking about working to support the mental health of children with an intellectual disability. So welcome to the 564 of you who are currently tuned into us. And I really also want to welcome the viewers who are watching this through a podcast. Welcome everybody, and thanks for your enthusiasm and for tuning in tonight. Emerging Minds and MHPN wishes to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay respects to elders past, present and future for the memories, the traditions, the cultures and hopes of Indigenous Australians. So, as I said, welcome to what is the third webinar in series two. And we, along with MHPN, are really looking forward to both bringing you tonight's webinar, but also an exciting series that we have coming up. And that includes the next available webinar, which will be later in April, which is supporting trans and gender diverse children and their families. The next one after that will be Aboriginal children and the effects of intergenerational trauma and engaging children and parents affected by child sexual abuse. So we hope you'll stay with us for those as we go across the year. So as I said, my name's Dan Moss and I'm the Workforce Development Manager at Emerging Minds. Really always a pleasure to be able to facilitate these sessions. Just a word about the platform. This is a new platform for many of you, and you'll notice that some of the navigation buttons have changed. So just a reminder about the function. To access the chat box, and please do, click on the purple button. If you have a question, and we always love to get your questions so that we can make sure that what we're talking about is relevant to what you need, please use the blue button. Slides and resources are available from the light blue download button. The refresh button is the green button. And there's also a help button if you need IT assistance, and you can message Redback directly or ring them on 1800 733 416. Okay, so we've got some learning outcomes that we want to cover with you tonight. So at the webinar's completion, we would like you to be able to identify the risk and protective factors for children where they have an intellectual disability. We'd like you to describe best practice of collaboration with families and children that achieve positive social and emotional wellbeing outcomes for children with intellectual disability, and to describe tools and tips for assessing, recording and reporting the mental health concerns in children with intellectual disability. So there are learning outcomes. And next up, it really is my pleasure tonight to be able to introduce our panel. And first of all, I'd like to introduce to you Emeritus Professor Stuart Einfield, who is a psychiatrist from New South Wales. Stuart, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You've got a long history as a psychiatrist and as an academic. I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about some of the progress that we've made in working with children with intellectual disability over the years.
Well, I think one step forward is that there's a much greater acceptance of the need for mental health intervention with children and families who have developmental disabilities. So while we've still got a long way to go in terms of service access, I think it's unquestionably much better than it was. When we started, autism was hardly heard about. Today, it's, you know, you can't avoid reading about it, and developmental disabilities are, you know, commonly discussed. So I think increased awareness is one. I think we've got a much better understanding of some aspects of the biology and the brain function than we used to have. And I think we've got better assessment tools and better intervention monitoring tool. So they would be, to me, the probably the main advances.
Thank you for that, Stuart. Really looking forward to hearing you speak tonight. So thanks again for joining us. Next of all, it's also my pleasure to be able to introduce Dr. Janina Schindler, who's a clinical and educational and developmental psychologist from New South Wales. Janina, welcome.
Thank you.
In your long history of supporting children and families, can you tell us what are your understandings of intellectual disability that have been most helpful for you?
I think I would go back to the importance of thinking of each child as an individual, regardless of what their diagnosis may be, because although a diagnosis may give you some sort of shortcut measure of understanding some of the challenges that the child may face, each child is different. So I think when you're looking at supporting a family or supporting a child with an intellectual disability, it's important not to sort of get blinded by the label and still think about the fact that you've got a child with behavioral, emotional, mental health support needs. And that child is within the context of a family. So I think that's probably the thing I always come back to.
Thanks so much for that, Janina. Really appreciate that. And again, really looking forward to hearing you speak shortly.
Thank you.
So we're going to start tonight's presentation with Stuart. But before we do, just a reminder about the case study, which hopefully you've had a chance to read, and that... The webinar is going to focus on Noah, who's a 9-year-old boy who lives at home with his mother, Amy, father, Ray, and a 10-year-old sister named Jessie. So as the case study goes along, young Noah has a moderate intellectual disability as well as some issues with the epilepsy and ADHD. So to first give us a bit of a background into how to be working with children and their families with intellectual disability, I'm going to hand over to Stuart. Stuart, welcome again.
Thanks. Okay, so I think it's good that we have as the first point here this issue about, you know, what are we talking about when we're talking about mental health problems? There's been a lot of confusion, especially about attempts to distinguish behaviour problems from mental health problems or psychiatric disorders. And the point I would like to make is that there is really no valid distinction between behavioural and emotional problems and mental health problems or psychiatric problems. And we're talking about all these collectively this evening. And the importance of this is that this supposed distinction between behaviour problems and mental health problems has actually largely been misused and misapplied as a way of restricting access of people with developmental disabilities to mental health services. So I would imagine that many of you in the audience have had the experience of, a child or an adult with an intellectual disability presenting to a mental health service and being told after some kind of very superficial assessment that, they've got a behaviour problem, not a mental health problem. It's important for you to understand that this is completely bunkum, and what we have to do is we have to understand the origins of their emotional and behavioural disturbances as an individual, just as Janina said, and we have to do what we can to help. And trying to make this kind of distinction, firstly, it's not scientifically valid in any way, and it's an excuse basically to avoid providing a service. So that's the first thing. Following again on from what Janina was saying about, you know, the labels, I completely agree. The labels have uses. They also have disadvantages. And one doesn't want to get too bogged down in, whether kids are called ODD or, and especially autism these days, given that you get more ready access to the NDIS, if you've got a label of autism, or just about any kid with a developmental disability who looks sideways is called autistic, it's become an almost useless diagnosis. So Nevertheless, the NDIS and other services, educational services, like official classifications, so one is obliged sometimes to use DSM or ICD labels. You know, that's okay if it's a, if you think that it's going to help your patient, but your client, but you know, don't get too bound by it. The other way of approaching classification is to start with the individual symptoms, the individual behaviours and emotions, which you can measure with various checklists, such as the developmental behaviour checklist, and then you then use factor analysis to work out the various domains of behaviour disturbance. So that's just about the labels and concepts. Now, when we talk about intellectual disability, it's actually a very wide range. And, you know, a person with mild intellectual disability, for example, is more similar to somebody who is in the average intelligence range than they are to somebody with profound intellectual disability. But basically, this is a very rough guide. If a person's got mild intellectual disability, their mental health problems are similar to the typically developing population, but they may be simpler in ideational content, and externalizing or disruptive problems are common. Once you move down to moderate and severe intellectual disability, you see quite a number of behaviors which are very unusual in the typically developing population, such as the self-injurious behaviors, the repetitive behaviors, and the kinds of rituals, you know, and stereotypies that you see in autism, for example. Once you go down even further to profound intellectual disability, well, in that range, you don't have a lot of behaviour, and so consequently, you don't have much behaviour disturbance. One thing we know about behaviour problems, firstly, there's an increased rate in children with developmental disabilities, and I use the term developmental disabilities really to encompass intellectual disability and autism. We know that there is an increased rate of behaviour problems, about three times that of the typically developing population. If the increase rate starts early and it continues to increase, and it declines slowly through young adulthood, but it still remains increased right through adulthood. I just want to go to the causes, and then I'll come back to the assessment issue. So the causes of mental health problems or behavioural emotional problems can be very broad, and in any individual, you will have a unique constellation of causes. So, you know, when you're thinking about the causes, it's best to have some kind of framework that you can use. So I just divide them into biological causes, psychological causes, and social causes. So in biological causes, you would include, these are just examples, it's not an exhaustive list, various aspects of brain dysfunction, the behaviour types of genetic syndrome. So among children with intellectual disability, their intellectual disability is caused by mainly genetic phenomena, and there are a range of particular genetic syndromes like Williams syndrome, Prader-Willi syndrome, Down syndrome, of course, which you know, and so on. And each of these is associated with particular types of behaviour and behaviour problems. And other biological function, you may have concurrent epilepsy. Of course, you may have sensory disturbances like, you know, visual and hearing impairments and so on, motor impairments. Then you go on to psychological factors. If they've got intellectual disability, there's a reduced capacity to find adaptive solutions to problems that the young people are faced with. And unfortunately, people with intellectual disability experience trauma and abuse at an increased level. And then other types of psychological factors are various learned maladaptive behaviour patterns. Then there are social factors, for example, stigma, exclusion, poverty. Poverty is a big issue. People have the same level of intellectual disability who are poor or in poor families have higher rates of behaviour disturbance than those who are not in poor families, and, of course, various kinds of family dysfunction. So these are just some of the causes, but it's a framework which would enable you to think about different factors which might be influencing behaviour disturbance in your patient. To go back to assessment, so I would just say these are just a few tips. Use multiple sources of information. So if it's a school-age child, I would virtually always get information from the school. You need to get information from everybody in the family, members of the extended family. If the child is involved in after-school programs and so on, you know, you're better off getting information from there as well, or activity programs. When you're gathering information, it's best to use both a combination of structured and unstructured techniques. So by structured techniques, I mean various sorts of established, valid and reliable questionnaires. And by unstructured techniques, you need to give the family and each individual in the family a carte blanche to express their view about the behavioural and emotional problems. When you're interacting with the person with intellectual disability, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but you would use language equivalent to their mental age, not their chronological age. And then there are a number of visual tools like pictograms, the Coop pictograms, for example, which can be used to enable the person with intellectual disability to describe their own emotion. And remember that impairments may vary in severity across different domains. And I've just given one example there. So children with Williams syndrome, for example, have quite a big difference between their expressive language is much better than their receptive language, and that's considerably better than their visuospatial function. So function is not necessarily even across the domain. I mentioned some behaviour assessment questionnaires. So there's a number of these. The Aberrant Behaviour Checklist is an American one, been used a lot in drug studies. The one that I've developed, I developed over many years, is the Developmental Behaviour Checklist. That's got versions for parents and one for teachers, and then there's adult ones as well. These can serve a lot of purposes, but one purpose is in systematically gathering data about the particular behaviour problems that are there. They can save you a lot of time. I get parents to complete it before they come into the interview, and that saves a lot of time. As well as that, I would say that for those of you who might be working in developmental clinics, for example, it's a good way of getting a standardised, structured account of children's behaviour and behaviour problems at a young age, and then you can follow it over time. And we don't have time to go into that into any greater detail. And it's available in 23 languages in Australia. Just a few points about assessment. This perhaps applies to teenagers more than Noah's age, but and older teenagers, but nevertheless, there has been a history of over-diagnosing psychosis and that using that as a justification for antipsychotic usage. And sometimes, you know, people say, oh, the person's talking and there's nobody there, and that's evidence of hallucinations. Well, it's not. It can be just a social, more of a social dysfunction. I mean, it's normal to talk to ourselves, except those of us who are well socialised tend not to do it out loud, or people think we're odd. But of course, it can be true delusions and hallucinations as well. People can, you know, I often hear somebody saying, oh, he's paranoid because he thinks that people are against him and saying nasty things about him. Well, maybe it could be real, so you'd have to check that out. On the other hand, depression tends to be underdiagnosed, I would say. And I've just noted there that, you know, if you've got epilepsy, especially complex partial seizures, it can have significant effects on behaviour. And also think about medications that people are taking and their effects on behaviour. So I'll hand over to Janina.
Thank you. So I guess one of the learning points was to consider protective factors. And I think really the point of this is the child lives within a system. And when you're doing an assessment of the child's behaviour, you also need to think about, well, what's going on around them? I mean, I often say to students that that I supervise, you know, what actually determines whether a child is brought for psychological therapy? And it's actually often nothing to do with the nature of the child's problem. It's often to do with the way that the parents perceive that problem and also the support that they have. So I think it was interesting the point that Stuart made about how poverty, so children with an intellectual disability living in poverty often have much more severe behaviour problems than perhaps children living in families where there are protective factors which come from access to financial resources or access to family support. But I think when we look at Noah, what is really critical for him is that you get the sense that the parents have a good relationship with him and they've tried to prioritize his needs and to provide him with a stable routine. He's got an appropriate educational placement, and that's not always the case for children with an intellectual disability. I often see, for example, younger children that may be struggling in mainstream, and I guess those of you who are living in, coming from more remote areas, may live in an area where there actually isn't a choice of educational placement and the child goes to the local school where there are not always the resources available to support that child adequately. Noah's also fortunate in that he's engaged with a speech therapy therapist to build his communication skills, and living in an urban area, he's got access to specialists, pediatricians or child psychiatrists, who can assess him and can prescribe appropriate medication. So again, I think being looked after by a multidisciplinary team, or at least access to having access to professionals from different backgrounds, can be really protective in that the child's actually receiving appropriate services. And we know that communication skills are really important in terms of behavior problems, that often children with the most severe behavior problems also have quite limited communication skills, which limit their capacity to express frustration or to communicate their needs in an appropriate way. Noah's also got, there's a history of his family having appropriately managed his behavior, and understanding what I think is really critical is that all behavior has a communicative intent. So when we look at a child's behavior, we should never be saying, oh, they're just being manipulative or difficult or aggressive, which sometimes people do say. You know, we really need to step back and think, okay, well, what's the purpose of this child's behavior? Because children are not aggressive for no reason. So really putting that behavior into a context is really important. And I think Noah's fortunate in this, in that his family already know this. And I think the other thing which we always need to bear in mind is that many of the families that we see with children or young adults with intellectual disability are often under increased stress. Because they may not have the support. And if their child has mental health or behavioral difficulties, sometimes it's actually incredibly hard caring for them. So in this example, we have Amy, who's got a mum who's got a history of postnatal depression, and Noah's got a sister with anxiety. But what's protective here is that there's a willingness to engage with services, which again, I think is critical. So when we look at risk factors, and some of these things are factors that Stuart's already identified, Noah has an intellectual disability, and that in itself makes him more vulnerable to developing behavioural problems. He also has ADHD and he has epilepsy. So all those things place him at an increased long-term risk of behavioural mental health challenges. And I think the other risk factor here is that his mum, she's a primary carer. She doesn't work outside the home. She's also got an aging mother that she may need to care for. She's got the history of postnatal depression, which we've already identified. So in looking at Noah's needs, we mustn't forget the needs of his parents. And I think any assessment needs to take that into consideration, because often parents who are under significant stress are simply not able to put into practice strategies which are going to help address their children's behavioural challenges. So we've already talked a bit about factors like developing his communication skills. Developing his communication skills, the importance of a predictable routine. That's probably important for all children, not just Noah. What's critical is responding consistently to his behaviour, and also the broadly things like managing his environment. So we already know that in the past, Noah's behaviour problems have been triggered by noise. And I think he's not a big fan of high temperatures. Unfortunately, he lives in Australia, so he's probably going to have to deal with that one. But, you know, this is where diagnosis can come in handy, in that some children with a diagnosis of autism may be particularly sensitive to certain environmental factors, or may have particular sensitivities. So we need to be aware of that when we're planning an intervention. And, you know, a simple step can be looking at how do we manage those. So, you know, a child with acute sensitivity to noise, can, if you get them some good earphones, you know, that may actually help a lot in terms of reducing their distress. We also need to review medication, and Stuart's already mentioned that obviously behaviour medication can have side effects, but also it's critical in the treatment of some children, for example, with epilepsy. What we don't know with Noah is, has there been some change in his epileptic activity which is impacting on his sleep? Again, what sort of support are this family getting? What sort of services are available to assist them in caring for Noah? So I think as a psychologist, I tend to probably look at two main factors. One is the family support. And as Stuart's already said, I think it's really important to meet with the parents and talk to them about their views and expectations, both of themselves as carers and of their child. What did they believe about Noah? So, you know, you get some children, some parents that will say, oh, you know, my child's being so manipulative, and look at that as a very negative. Whereas if you step back, what you might realize is, you know, the child is doing their best to exert some control over their environment. And most people can kind of understand that if you explain, well, you know, you can exert influence by talking to people. Maybe your child can't do that. So the only way they're going to control their environment is through their behavior. And again, sometimes that shift in beliefs and understanding of the child's behavior can have a profound influence in how the family then deal with the behavioral challenges that they face. That sort of family support and you know, individual support for carers who may be themselves depressed or under a lot of stress, I think is always very critical. And that can fit well within the role of a psychologist or a social worker. Actually, I think it's probably the role of any therapist that parents can talk to you about some of the stresses they're facing and feel that you understand the challenges. And obviously, then there's behavioural support. So more specifically, looking at how do we understand this child's behaviour? And I'm hoping most of you will be familiar with the idea of an ABC chart. So looking at antecedents, So what comes before the behaviour, B stands for behaviour, and C is consequences. So at a very simple level, okay, what happens before the child has a meltdown? How do you react when your child has a meltdown? That can be incredibly informative. And you would look at what happens at home and at the school, and then look at, you know, what are the triggers and what are reinforcing the behaviours. So when we identify triggers, and sometimes that's easier to do than at other times, how can they be modified? So I gave a very simple example. Child has a meltdown when there's a lot of noise. Sometimes a simple strategy like noise cancelling earphones, those things, not earphones, whatever they're called, can make a huge difference to a child's life. If a child is very sensitive to textures, and they always have a meltdown when it's time to go to school and they're putting shoes and socks, you might work out that actually they just have a strong aversion to the feel of their socks. And changing something simple as that can make a huge difference. Obviously, sometimes the trigger more complex. And then the other thing we think about is what reinforces these behaviours. And I think it's really, really important to remember that often with children with an intellectual disability, attention, whether that's positive or negative, can reinforce a behaviour. So, you know, sometimes we think, well, why on earth would they be doing that if they get shouted at or if they get smacked or if, you know, the parent gets very agitated? Well, if your understanding of how the world functions is limited, sometimes having a parent, you know, going, why are you doing that? What are you doing? You know, lots of facial expressions, lots of gesticulating, that can be quite reinforcing. And often parents don't understand that. So, you know, looking at reinforcers, which can be both rewards. So, you know, you do get children who might tantrum and then they're given lollies because the parents know that makes them quiet. So the child learns, okay, a great way to get lollies is to have a meltdown. But also the idea that we understand that a behaviour can be reinforced by negative consequences. Negative attention is also reinforcing. So I've already talked about this. We need to look at circumstances which can make the behaviour more or less likely, look at the antecedents and consequences. And going back to the point, the challenging behaviours rarely occur without a precipitant. So there are occasionally children who get very distressed and it's difficult to work out what's going on. We also need to kind of factor in physical factors like pain. For teenage girls, you know, it might be around the time that they're getting their period or something like that. Those aren't things that the young person themselves is going to articulate. They may not actually be able to tell you that they're in pain. So it's always important to have that on the list of things to think about. As I've already mentioned, identify the gains of a behaviour. So again, some children have a tantrum, mum, dad wants to shut you up, you get a lolly, great reinforcer. And for those psychologists out there, the question I'd have, see if you can answer it, what's the most powerful form of reinforcement? You don't have to answer it, but those of you who had intermittent reinforcement get a virtual gold star, because basically it's if one in five times the child gets a lolly for having a tantrum, they will carry on having tantrums, because what they've learned is, well, you never know when you're in luck. So I think it's just important to remember that intermittent reinforcement. And what, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is reward and build more adaptive solutions, and trying to skill up the child and build really on the things that they're doing well. So although sometimes we need to focus on, you know, diminishing the problematic behaviour by using time out or something, more often than not, rewarding the behaviour we want to see more of is incredibly powerful, helping the child develop appropriate communication skills so they don't have to have a meltdown in order to get what they need, looking at environmental triggers. All those factors are things we need to consider. So we select one behaviour at a time, usually the behaviour which is causing the most concern. Ideally, the behaviour must be easily to understand by the child and the parents, so not, you know, reinforcing, oh, being a good boy. We need to have specifics. So I tend to try and I always think you try and reward the behaviour you want to see more of. So say if the child is kicking his sister, you'd be looking at rewarding keeping your hands and feet to yourself. Pick a reward that matters to the child, and that's a skill in itself, because you need to understand what makes the child tick. Some children you can make great changes with glittery stickers. Some children, you know, iPad time. Some children choosing your dessert. Some children money or points. It really depends. But that I think step three is critical. And you've got to make it interesting. So the reward may need to change over time, or it might need to be a little bit more difficult for the child to get the reward. So on a very simple level, if you're, say, looking at enuresis, bedwetting, you might start off with a reward for every dry night. And as the child manages that, you might change it to a reward for every two dry nights or three dry nights or a week. Usually, if a behavioral program works, you'll find it sort of naturally, the child doesn't need the reward because the behavior's improved. But that's the consistency. And the time between the behavior and the reward has to be close enough to be within the child's time concept. So most children, young children, particularly with an intellectual disability, they're not going to cope with one reward at the end of the day for a behavior they've done in the morning. You probably need to reward almost instantaneously. Obviously, with an older child, or a more able, intellectually able child, you can extend that. But often with children with intellectual disability, the rewards need to be fairly often immediate, or if not immediate, very soon after the behaviour you're trying to build. As I've said, in terms of building skills, step five, you're really trying to help the child find a more adaptive way to achieve what he or she wants. So that may be teaching the parents, you've really got to notice when they're doing the right thing. Because often what parents do, particularly if they're stressed, you know, if the child's being well-behaved and quiet, they might just ignore them. They'll be going, oh, thank goodness for that, I can get on with cleaning or I can have my cup of tea. But actually that's the time when they need to be giving the child positives. And I always sort of talk about it like kind of money in the bank. That if the child gets enough attention for the positive behaviours, often it sort of satiates them and they don't need to be doing the less adaptive stuff in order to get attention. And this is where we're also looking at skills. So whether it's building their communication skills or helping them regulate their arousal or looking at sensory sensitivities. So really we need to build in all those steps. Now, Stuart's going to talk a little bit about the developmental behaviour checklist, which is you can buy. It's quite affordable. And if for those of you who want to do something more structured, this is a good tool. So over to you, Stuart.
Thanks, Janina. I'm just going to go back because there was one item there that I think dropped off the list there. So step six, which I think is very important, is that the child should be able to tell you, describe the reward program to you. So I couldn't tell you the number of times parents have said to me, oh, we tried reward charts and it didn't work. And I say, well, you know, did Johnny know what he had to do? And they say, oh, yes, he knew exactly what he had to do. And I say to Johnny, you know, well, what did you have to do to get the reward? And Johnny says, I had to be good. And you say, well, what do you have to do to be good? And Johnny says, I don't know. This has happened countless times. So that if the child should be able to tell you, and you need to test this with the child when you're designing this program, what the child should be able to tell you what behavior they've got to do, what the reward is, and when they're going to get it. If not, if the program's too complicated, and I really recommend to you that you were on the side of making the behavior program too simple rather than too complicated. They usually fail because they're too complex. The other thing about it is that with behavioral interventions or any interventions, and this includes pharmacological drug treatments, I've found that it's much better if you've got some kind of a systematic way of measuring whether your intervention is working or not. And the reason is because kids with developmental disabilities have very complicated lives, and you know, you prescribe some treatment, and then 3 months later, however long, the parents come back and say, you know, what's happened? And they say, oh, well, you know, he got better for a while, and then he didn't, but we think it was working. And then they say, oh, but you know, but grandma came and stayed, and then the dog died, and then some other life event happened, and then he got sick. And it becomes so complex that you really can't work out, you can't differentiate the effects of your treatment from the effects of all these other changes in life circumstances. And also, you know, Achenbach, the author of the Child Behaviour Checklist, taught us that when you ask people to retrospectively give an account of children's behaviour, there are all kinds of distortions which come into it, which we don't have time to go into. But if you ask people for example, there's the recency bias, which means that if you say to people, you know, how's Johnny been over the last 6 months, they tend to describe what he's been like over the last 2 days. Then there's the saliency bias. So, you know, if Johnny throws something in the house and it doesn't hit anything, then they say it's not a problem. If it happens to smash a valuable family heirloom, they say it's a terrible problem, even though Johnny's behaviour is exactly the same. So, I mean, and there's a whole series of other biases. So the point is that what you do with this is the monitoring version of the DBC. You can design your own, but this is the way I do it. You pick up to 5 items and you get the parents to rate them every day. And the 5 items are items that you are particular targets of your intervention, or they might be particular side effects you want to be monitoring for. And you get them to rank them, you get them to rate them prospectively. And all they have to do is every day I tell people, put this on your bedside table. And before you go to sleep, take each of these behaviours that we've agreed are the key behaviours, and I've just picked some random ones here. They're not particularly to do with Noah, by the way. You know, you just score it. 2, was it a severe problem today? 1, was a moderate-sized problem? 0, wasn't a problem. It takes them, you know, a couple of minutes to score the 5 items, and then they do that every day. And at the end of the week, you end up with a weekly total. And then in the next slide, you graph, and you can get the families to graph. They're usually better with Excel or whatever than I am. And then you can see. So what you're looking for is seeing whether the behaviours are getting better over time. And the longer you do that, one for each behaviour. And the longer they keep this going, the better. Because, for example, let's say there is a issue of behaviour problems associated with menstrual cycle. Well, you're going to see a spike every, you know, 4 weeks or whatever. It could be worse in the winter if they've got some seasonal affective component. And you can plot on it, you know, if there are changes in treatment at any point. The point is, the issue is that structured, prospective measurement of how the effects of your intervention is much more valid than retrospective and unstructured monitoring. Do you want me to talk to this, Janina, or?
So I think I was just going to say we're on 21. I think I've probably covered this one, but I'll just recap some of the items, particularly in relation to NDIS, because obviously that's opened up, potentially opened up access to services For a lot of people, although again, depending on which area you live in, you may or may not have appropriate services within easy access. But I think my top tip of writing support letters for people with NDIS applications, and Stuart may have his own ones, is I've gone simple. I've seen people being rejected for NDIS applications when they've got sort of tomes which talk about trauma and all sorts of things. Often NDIS don't understand that. And I think they do understand diagnosis. So going back to the point that Stuart made, there are times when a diagnosis is very handy. And certainly in NDIS speak, the more diagnosis you have, the handier it is. So, you know, putting in those DSM codes, very useful. And also NDIS understand money. So very often, if I put in something, I will just add a sentence saying, in my opinion, you know, the child would benefit from X number of sessions, costed at such and such a price, total for the year would be X. That saves the NDIS planner a lot of time. They've got the diagnosis, they've got the money, they've got the cost. They're much more likely to take that on board than if you write three paragraphs spelling out, you know, the child's history and everything else. So sometimes in my experience, keeping it brief, using NDIS language can be the most effective. And I've also mentioned, you know, there are some very good programs. Again, depending where you live, you may or may not be able to access those, but you may be familiar with the Stepping Stones Triple P adaptation, which Stuart was involved in. And that's a specific version of Triple P for parents of children with an intellectual disability or developmental delay. And I've also Carers Australia. Now, they're in the process of change, and I'm not quite sure what their services will look like later this year, but up till now, they have offered free counselling for carers. I think they will continue offering some online support. Whether they will offer the face-to-face counselling, I don't know. But it is useful, regardless of where you live, to be aware of what are the other services in my area that are good, that I can suggest, and of services like Carers New South, Carers Australia, which is a national service and is focused on helping carers, obviously, as their name suggests. Now, Stuart's going to talk a bit about pharmacological treatment, which again, I think absolutely there is a role to play, as long as, and I think this is where the expertise of the prescriber comes in. And again, it depends where you work. If you're in a metropolitan city, there will be people, specialists like Stuart, or other pediatricians or psychiatrists who have the expertise. Obviously, if you're in a more remote area, you may be more dependent on a family doctor or having to travel to access a medical specialist. So, Stuart, I don't know, do you want to say a little bit more about this?
Yes. So, sorry, we're on to slide 22. So this is a summary of an approach to prescribing. So for those, if there are doctors in the audience who prescribe, I'll just take you to this. Oh, sorry, I don't know where is the list of resources.
So, Stuart, the resources, there's a tab for people at the end of the webinar which we'll go through, which will have a resource on them. Yes.
Okay, well, when we get to that, I'll comment then about one of the particular articles which describes this in a systematic way and in more detail. I was just looking for that reference there. But anyway, just one thing to keep in mind, you know, you... you're prescribing has to comply with the Guardianship Act, and that varies a bit between one state and the other. Won't apply in New South Wales to 9-year-olds, but if your patient is over 16, it will. Just a general thing, tranquilizers, major tranquilizers especially, tend to be over-prescribed. You need to use a systematic approach. You've got to identify exactly what your name, exactly what your targets are, and they need to be much better if you've got specific targets, which you can then monitor in the with the DBCM that I showed you with the chart, rather than vague notions of, you know, we want to hope the medication will help him to function better or something, which you're never going to be able to measure accurately. Decide on what the maximum dose is that you're going to go up to before you start. Monitor effects and side effects in a systematic way. Remember that side effects and dosage sensitivities are more common in this population because the child's brain is not typical to start with, and so the effects of medication are often less predictable, so you've got to be extra cautious. And withdraw slowly. Now, I've listed there some of the different types of psychotropic drugs which we use to try to treat behavioural or assist in the treatment of behavioural and emotional problems in this population. We don't have time now to describe the use and the benefits and side effects and so on and application of each of these. Maybe if there's time in the questions, somebody's got a burning question, we may do that. But of course, the drugs that are available, you know, change over time. So I think it's most important. The message I'd like to give you is that you use a systematic approach to prescribing. I very often see perhaps older children, you know, maybe a teenager who's had a whole lot of trials has been exposed to a whole lot of different psychotropic medications. The effects were never measured properly, and you really cannot work out, even after years of prescribing, you really can't work out, you know, what was a benefit, what was a minor benefit, what was a major benefit, was the problem inadequate dosage and so on. And the whole, you know, trying to put together a retrospective understanding of their exposure and experience with medications is impossible. Okay, so I'll stop there, Dan.
Yeah, thank you, Stuart. And, I just want to thank you and Janina. They were really great and insightful presentations. And thanks also to the 860 of you who are currently online. That's a phenomenal amount of interest in this subject. So we're really pleased with that. Also, we're really pleased with the great questions that are coming through the chat room. Thanks also to Jackie from Emerging Minds for managing that. Janina, I'm going to start with you because we've got lots of questions from people like Naomi and Noel who are all really focusing on the family of someone with a child with intellectual disability. And their questions really are talking about the importance of encouraging parents to collaborate with you or other professionals to really get to know what's going to work best for their child. Have you got a comment on that?
Oh, yes, I mean, absolutely. Collaboration is, I think, at the heart of any effective intervention. I mean, not just with a child with an intellectual disability, probably with anyone. And look, I think one of the key skills you can have is simply to listen. And often people have a story they want to tell you. And I think if they trust you and they trust you to respect that story, you know, that's a very good start. I mean, that doesn't always happen. I've been in practice for a very long time and occasionally you see families who they just have a particular perspective. I guess the most problematic ones are either when they see their child in a very negative way. So those terms about, you know, the child being, oh, he's only being manipulative, you know, he's being aggressive, he's being violent. You know, I've heard a three-year-old being described as violent, and you think, well, that's a concern if you can't shift that parent's perception of a three-year-old as being aggressive and violent. And I think the other problematic situation is occasionally I meet families whose entire identity is about a sort of problem infused. So in a way, the problems that they have are like a badge of honor. It gives them a structure to their lives. On some ways, you know, their child is more complex than any other child you've seen. And regardless of what you say, they're not going to be happy with it. So, you know, you can get problems in working cooperatively with people, and occasionally you just don't click. You know, people sometimes don't like you for whatever reason. But, you know, the key thing is that cooperative endeavor, that what you're doing comes from a place of working cooperatively with the family. I don't know if that answers the question.
Absolutely does, Janina. Thank you so much for that. Another question which has come through from Kate and others has been, considering that Noah has a sibling, an older sister, within your practice, Janina, are there times when you are able to consider the child's relationship with the sibling?
Yeah, absolutely. So, look, I think there's sort of there's various things that we might do. Occasionally you see families where the focus is so much on the child with a disability that the sibling kind of almost gets sidelined and is expected to be extremely mature and independent. And obviously then part of the intervention is about how you help the parents understand that they also need to address the sibling's need. And sometimes one of the things that parents often find very difficult, I've heard parents talk about, you know, say going to the shopping centre and they feel obliged to take all the children, and the child with the intellectual disability may have sensory sensitivities, or they may just not be able to cope with the world when they see their favourite toy at the checkout at Woolies. And sometimes those expeditions end very badly. So sometimes giving parents permission to say, look, you know, it's absolutely perfectly all right to leave Noah at home and sometimes go for afternoon tea with Jesse. Or, you know, sometimes those family events might just be too much for Noah. It's actually okay occasionally not to take him along. So, you know, that's kind of giving people permission to focus on their normally developing child. Some services do siblings groups, so I'd say, you know, if you work in a service that's got a lot of children coming in, sometimes a siblings group can be really helpful, which is focused on helping children the siblings understand some of their negative and positive feelings that they may have about having a disabled sibling. And we also, I'm always mindful, so for example, if somebody like Jesse was presenting in my service, I'd be looking at getting one of my colleagues involved in actually maybe doing some individual work with Jesse or working with the family on assisting Jesse with her anxiety. So yes, and I think that's part of thinking about the whole family. But, you know, the thing that there's two things that I always say to parents. One is, I think there's a lot of literature that talks about actually that siblings of children with a disability can grow up to be much more empathic and positive members of society. So it's not necessarily a negative as long as their needs have been met. And that involves also acknowledging that sometimes the sibling can feel very negative feelings towards their younger brother in this case, you know, that allowing the child to be able to say, you know, sometimes I really hate when Noah screams, or sometimes I find, you know, he's a real embarrassment to me when I'm with my friends. I think allowing children to say that, as well as obviously the positive things, is important. And also allowing older siblings, sometimes parents go, well, look, he knows, you know, we've talked to him about autism, he should understand. Just recognizing that, you know, actually adults sometimes struggle with that. A 10-year-old may be able to tell you all about autism, but that doesn't mean that when their younger brother or sister is being extremely difficult, they're going to be able to go, oh, well, that's fine. I'm not going to get upset because I know they have autism. So, yeah, that's a few things to think about there, I guess.
Thank you, Janina. Stuart, a lot of questions for you around the connection between Noah and his intellectual disability and his mental health. So how would you support Noah's parents to remain hopeful and confident in nurturing Noah's mental health? I know that you certainly touched upon that, but would you like to explore that a little bit more?
Well, I think in terms of maintaining their confidence, I think that is conveyed by the treating clinician that is supported, that's helped if the treating clinician demonstrates that they're able and willing to develop a thorough and patient understanding of the problems. And that they're, willing to validate everybody's opinion, or they're at least willing to give everybody the opportunity in the family to express their views about it. And I think to convey the idea that you've got some process in mind for developing an understanding of the what's caused the current problems, and that you've got some kind of a rational approach to trialing interventions. Now, none of that means that you try to maintain their hope by minimising the problems and saying, oh, well, I'm sure we can fix it up, because sometimes we can't. But I think that they will feel confident if they get the idea that you are willing to give it your best understanding, your best, and that you're willing to try sensible trials of different approaches. And I think what's important is that is never to say to the family, "Well, there's no more I can do for you," which is really a way of saying, go away. I've learned never to say that to people, because I discovered that people value, even if you as the therapist feel that you're not able to deliver much, people do value the fact that you're willing to stay with them and the family and support the family with the problem, even if you can't change it much. And at least even if you always show that you are open and that you are looking for new avenues of intervention, it could be seeking second opinions, it could be trialing out novel interventions if they're safe. So I think that's what I would say about keeping up parents' hope, even when at times they are feeling hopeless, or even the therapist is feeling rather hopeless.
Yeah, so Stuart, I'm really interested in that, because what's come through from a lot of what you've said is really that kind of idea of staying with the family and continuing to collaborate with them. How do you let them know in the first session that that's what you're most interested in? What are the kind of key messages that you're wanting to provide a family when they first come in to see you in that very first session?
Well, I think it's largely, I think Janina's covered this to a fair extent. You want to understand it from the viewpoint of, this is what Steelman called multidirectional partiality. That's to say, you want to be partial to everybody's point of view and not to be judgmental. So you want to know, what's the problem look like to mum? What's it look like to dad? Certainly, what's it look like from the point of view of Jessie, the sister, and what's it look like from the Noah's point of view? So families feel good about your interview if they feel that they have been understood, heard, and understood.
Thank you, Stuart. Janina, a question from you, from Sabu, who, a great question. Where the parents of a child with intellectual disability may have an intellectual disability themselves, how are you able to work with them to be able to kind of describe some of the effects of intellectual disability or mental health on their child?
Well, I think Stuart made the point early on that, you know, if you're dealing with somebody with an intellectual disability, you need to communicate with them at the level of their communication. So I would say if the parents themselves have an intellectual disability, you have to keep it clear and simple and kind of check in with what their understanding is. So, you know, sometimes when I'm finishing off a session with parents, and I maybe make some suggestions, I might jot those down on a piece of paper. Obviously, that's not going to be helpful if somebody has limited literacy skills. But I might actually say to them, okay, just run by me. What are the main points we raised and what do you need to be doing? And then, you know, I remember full well what the points I've made, but if they can explain it back to me, then they've understood it. Much like Stuart said, if you write a behaviour program, if the child can't understand what they're getting rewarded for and what they have to do, it's a bit pointless. You know, sometimes I've used visuals. So, I mean, this is more for children, but, you know, again, you could adapt it. So rather than writing, I would do my best to do little kind of my cartoons of things, just as prompts, as reminders for these are the key things you have to remember. And I think be realistic. Obviously, if the parents have an intellectual disability and they have very limited support and they have a challenging child, you know, that fail unless they're supported. You know, at the worst case scenario, you may be dealing with a situation where there is real risks of significant harm to the child because the parents are unable to understand their needs or unable to, you know, put into place strategies which might protect the child. But I think that's worst case scenario. I think the starting point is, you know, keep it simple. Are these parents able to understand what you're saying, understand, take on board some of the concepts? Do they have support in place to assist them? So, you know, if there's a support worker for the parents, get them to come to the interview so that they can take on board what you're saying and then they can support the parents in a much more hands-on way. And sometimes also with parents with an intellectual disability, you have to show them by doing it. Words aren't enough. Sometimes you actually have to demonstrate. And obviously it depends on what sort of service you work in. I don't do home visits, but certainly, again, with NDIS, you might be looking at home-based support services who can actually work side by side with the parents to demonstrate the skills. I don't know if that answers the question.
It certainly does, yes. And thank you. It's a really shame because there's really great questions here at the moment, but we are kind of running out of time. So that we've got 881 participants at the moment, lots of them asking really great questions, and we will see if we can get to those. But for now, what I'm going to ask both you, Stuart and Janina, to do is just provide some final thoughts for us, just in a minute or two, just to kind of sum up final thoughts for tonight. So I might start with you, Stuart, if that's okay.
Well, I of course I'm not really aware of the professional position of all the participants, but. And you'll each have different priorities, but I would say that working with families of children with developmental disabilities is often challenging, but it's very rewarding. please try to apply the general principles you've learned about family assessments and family interventions and childhood interventions, but with some particular modifications and refinements that have been touched on this evening. Hang in there with the families. Feel free to ask questions. If people want to email me, you can do so, and I'll try to answer your questions more specifically. If you're willing to hang in there with the families, they will greatly appreciate it, and it will prove of great benefit to the young person in the long run.
Thank you so much, Stuart. Janina?
I guess in terms of for the psychologists out there, often people don't necessarily work with children or young people with an intellectual disability as part of their training. So sometimes it can seem a bit overwhelming. I think the principles that you can apply to working with any child or family can apply to children, the families where there is a child with an intellectual disability. If you're not sure, get supervision. Like Stuart said, some of this work it's more long-term work. It can be very rewarding. Don't underestimate the benefit of just listening and being with people and actually acknowledging, say, the distress that parents might face. It can be very rewarding. I've been a psychologist for a very long time. I always think there's new things you can learn. So if you're interested in this area, you know, start by reading some of these resources. I mean, you've all come to this webinar, so there's an interest there. So school yourself up and kind of go for it, because like Stuart said, you know, sometimes these families can be excluded from services. Obviously, with the advent of NDIS, there's more options, say, if you're in private practice, to get, to make this work viable. But, you know, learn and don't be put off. That's it.
Once again, thank you so much, Janina. And once again, I just really want to thank both you and Stuart. I think all of our audience will agree, the almost 900 of them, that tonight's presentations have been incredibly informative and worthwhile. So thank you. And as Stuart suggested, let's keep these conversations going. I think they're obviously very, very useful ones for all of us in whatever sectors we're in. So just a reminder that there are some resources and further reading for you. So please click on the light blue icon at the top of the screen. And also just a reminder about the exit survey. So please go to the yellow icon at the top right and fill in the exit survey, feedback survey, so that we can make sure that we're delivering the best possible product to you. So really appreciate you doing that. So the next webinar in our series for Emerging Minds and MHPN is the Supporting Trans and Gender Diverse Children and Their Families, which will be on the 23rd of April. There's also a couple of MHPN webinars coming up. One of them, Mental Illness, Terrorism and Grievance Fueled Violence, Understanding the Nexus, on Tuesday the 18th of February, and Responding to the Needs of a Person Who Presents with Suicidality, on Monday the 23rd of March. So just a few words before we go about the partnership between MHPN and Emerging Minds. This webinar was co-produced by MHPN and Emerging Minds for the Emerging Minds National Workforce Centre for Children Mental Health Project. The project is led by Emerging Minds and delivered in partnership with the Australian Institute of Family Studies, the Australian National University, the Parenting Research Centre, and the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. MHP supports the engagement and ongoing maintenance of practitioner networks, where clinicians from different disciplines meet regularly with other mental health practitioners, share tips and resources, and build local referral pathways and engage in CPD activities. To learn more about this, please go to mhpn.org.au. So before I close tonight, I'd just like to acknowledge the consumers and carers who live with mental health illness, currently and in the past, and those who continue to live with mental illness. Thank you to everyone for your participation this evening. It's been a great webinar. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope to see you for the future ones. Thank you and good night.
Thank you.